Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Movie Geeks United Summer of 1986 series. Tonight, Poltergeist 2, The Other Side. Released on May 23, 1986, Poltergeist 2 might not have embodied the unforgettable sense of family heart and dark magic that characterized the first film, but it still contains several harrowing scenes and reunites the very appealing Freeling family, including Jo Beth Williams, Craig T. Nelson, Heather O'Rourke, and Oliver Robbins, who returned to play young son Robbie. In this conversation, Mr. Robbins discusses his involvement in the Poltergeist films, the contrasts between the two films, and his current career as an independent filmmaker.
You were something like, what was it, 9 years old in the first Poltergeist?
In the first installment of the Poltergeist movies, yes, I was 9 years old. I believe I turned 10 on the set. The shoot was around, at least my part was around 3 months. However, I think the entire production went on for close to 5.
So tell me about the circumstances surrounding your audition for that film. Was acting was something that you were already on track to pursue?
Well, you know, when I was 9 years old, or approximately right before I was about to turn 9, I told my mother, I saw these kids on television, and I'd love to try my hand at acting. And it was common in Los Angeles, especially at that time, for many children to act in television. And my parents actually didn't want me to act at all. They were very protective, and I had to persuade them. So at the end of many moments of begging, they finally they relented, and they put me in a commercial workshop class. At the end of the class, I was introduced to a couple of agents, and I actually only done one commercial before I actually auditioned for Poltergeist. Poltergeist was an open call, and I believe they had looked in New York and Chicago, and outside MGM, which is now Columbia, there were hundreds of people, and I stood in line, like everyone else, and they gave us some dialogue to read. I read it. I went home thinking nothing was going to happen at all. Lo and behold, after a series of callbacks, I got the part, and I was utterly amazed, because I really wasn't a professional actor. I was just good at being a kid.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that that's exactly what they were looking for.
Yes.
That natural quality, yeah.
I mean, I think that's the thing that's wonderful about all of, you know, Toby and Spielberg's movies is the children are so natural, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's a shame when you see movies when you see these little adults. And kids are, our children, and they're supposed to act as such when they're on movie, in their film, because you get something so special, you know, when you capture that, the wonderment of childhood.
And were you aware of Mr. Spielberg at that point? Were you a movie buff at that point?
It's funny. I didn't know who Steven Spielberg was at that point, but I loved his movies. I just really didn't understand what a director did or any of the filmmaking crew actually did. I know there was someone who was supposed to tell me what to do, and I listened to the team because they had over 80 people, I believe, on that set. And only after that did I fall in love with this filmmaking process, and I wanted to learn everything I possibly could, and that's why I went to I graduated USC Film School.
That had to have been – or maybe it wasn't, but I would think it would be overwhelming because this is a massive production that you're part of, first time out of the gate, really, on a feature film. Were you intimidated at all, or were you just soaking it in and loving it?
Well, you know, I think ignorance is bliss, especially at that age,
yeah.
Because you aren't intimidated at all because you don't know who you're really working with. For me, it was simply like going to summer camp. They said instead of doing making lanyards or building blocks or anything along those lines, we were making a movie. And I think the entire team was so fantastic. I remember Frank Marshall, the producer, was saying you're gonna love the set. He was introducing it like it was camp. Like we built this entire house on the soundstage. You're gonna go down in it. You can play with it. And that was basically how the entire process was introduced to me. It was all about having fun, having a great time, learning about the process. It was never introduced to me as a job. Like, you're going to have to stand here, you're going to have to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a blast. I didn't want it to end. You know, when they wrapped every day, I wanted to hang out with the crew and just watch the filmmaking process. And I just made me just fall in love with the entire filmmaking process and how everyone on the set has such a critical role in it. And it makes you appreciate what every single person, whether it's, whether it's a crew on a studio movie where you're doing 10 people, or you have a studio movie with over 100, they're all so critical
right.
to the success of the production.
And I guess it's important, too, and I know this from Mr. Spielberg and Mr. Hooper sets, to create an environment that is conducive to that kind of open creativity, especially when it comes to working with children.
Well, I mean, yes, they introduced it as being like a playground where you could have fun and just explore. And, something Spielberg and Hooper had in mind is letting me just be a kid. So, Steven, who had written the screenplay, he said that I could just basically go off the script. And Toby directed as such as well, too, where he just let me, said, you're in this, you're playing with your toys right here. What would you do in your room? I said, okay, I'll have fun and I'll play with my toys like I'm a kid. And many of those lines in the movie were actually ad-libbed. And, of course, they're such pros and experts. They guided me. It wasn't like I went off on a tangent and I said, I made up exactly what I wanted to go along. But they allowed me to be a kid within the structure of the scenes themselves. So those scenes seemed very natural because, indeed, I was being a kid.
And what makes the movie so great? And why you feel so invested in the film is because it really does feel like a family, a kind of normal, loving family. So was that environment present with your co-stars?
It certainly was. I was in the first one in the sequel, and we became a close family over the entire shoot. And it's funny, when I was shooting on a location, a person I was watching a shoot came up to me and said, where are your parents? And I pointed to my mom and dad who were watching me act off set. And they said, no, where are your real parents? And they were referring to, but Joe Beth and Craig. And, it was funny because we really were, they were my adopted parents, I believed, because I really didn't know, really a lot about acting, it was so nice to have people that were so wonderful with children. And Joe Beth and Craig, helped me as any parents would do. They were just my screen parents.
And there's some real childhood fears explored in Poltergeist, the Poltergeist films. And obviously, one of the most memorable scenes in the first is your encounter with the tree and the clown.
Right, of course.
When you're in the environment, when you're shooting a scary film, Does that translate into the atmosphere on set, or is it completely different? Is it not scary at all, the reality of actually shooting it?
You know, it's funny you ask that, because, you know, as I've, you know, become a filmmaker myself, and it's hard to explain exactly what you're going to see when you're doing a special effects sequence. And that was an issue, actually, on set. You know, watching a production off, if you're not acting, it's almost like watching paint dry, because it's a very, very slow process. So all the special effects were added in after the fact. So, you know, Toby would be like waving a stick at us and saying, this, what you're seeing, that's your point of view, and that's the ghost coming at you. And then we'd ask, like, what are we looking at here? And he'd say, the scariest thing you can think of. You know, we don't know quite yet, but it's going to be terrifying. So in your mind, it was all, you had to pretend like I'm seeing this horrible ghost and I'm terrified. And, you know, and you're shooting a scene, you might only shoot maybe a half a page a day, which it translates into maybe 20 or 30 seconds on screen, because you're doing all the various pieces of coverage, which is one, they set up the camera and they do the various angles. So it's a very slow process, and you have to, you know, when it's all assembled and all the pieces of the puzzle come together and they've laid in all the special effects, that's where the magic of filmmaking really comes through.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about when you first saw it assembled, what was your reaction?
I was utterly amazed how great it was. We knew we were doing something great, and everyone talked about it. They were even talking about a potential sequel even while we were, you know, shooting the first one. But, you know, when you what you think and what you finally see are two different things. When all the pieces of the puzzle were finally put together and I sat there and watched it, believe it or not, I was actually scared too by many of the scenes that I had actually acted in, because I didn't know exactly how they were going to assemble them. I thought it was just a fantastic film, even when I watched it when I was 10 years old. And, I saw pieces of it just a couple months ago, and I'm thinking, this is just a fantastic movie. And I don't believe it just because I was in it, but, it's amazing how that film has really stood up over the time, and how many other movies have drawn from it, and how it's become a major film, and, you know, that other filmmakers can really go to and, you know, pull from in their filmmaking repertoire.
It has survived, and it hasn't dated at all, and I do attribute it to the performances and the kind of genuine feeling of the family in that movie, that you genuinely care for them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's critical. And I think, you know, Mr. Spielberg once told me when he was teaching me about film that compassion will always win over camera. And what he was referring to is that what's critical, you can have the most amazing, wonderful special effects in the film, and those are very, very important. But what an audience is really going to hold to and understand, and why they're going to be captivated by the movie, are the relations between the characters. And that's something Poltergeist has. I mean, obviously, you know, last 30 years, you know, we've had many technological advances, and the special effects are better. But, you know, like you were saying, the reason why Poltergeist really holds up, it's the relationship between the characters and the reaction to those special effects. The special effects are critical, but they aren't why the audience is actually watching the movie.
I think it's humorous, because we did speak to Michael Grace, who I think is a co-writer on the Poltergeist films.
Yes,
years ago.
Yes,
and
wrote Poltergeist and Poltergeist 2.
Yes, and I recall that he was telling me that his conversations with Spielberg at the time, and Spielberg felt like Poltergeist was going to be a big hit, but he felt like that E.T. was going to bomb, because he had made E.T. around the same time. And they saw E.T. and they said, are you crazy? This movie is going to change the world. That always comes to mind when I think about the Poltergeist and the conversations about Spielberg with that movie. But your life, obviously, it had to have changed somewhat. You're in one of the great, big, successful movies at that time. So you officially got bitten by the acting bug, I'm sure, at that point, and you knew this is what you wanted to do with your life.
Well, actually, you know, I never, even after Poltergeist, I never saw it as something that I wanted to do for my career. That's why I really got out of it at 16, 17 years old. I just saw it as a fun chapter. What I wanted to do, and what Poltergeist really gave me, is my passion for filmmaking, and that's why I really focused on my studies in high school, and you know, it was very difficult to get into USC film school at the time, and you had to have a high GPA. So that's what I did. I was into my academics, and I studied as hard as I possibly could, and took all the AP classes, and made it into USC cinema, where I studied films.
You made your first movie at 15, didn't you?
Actually, I was making my first films at 10 years old, and I made these claymation films. Spielberg had actually given me a Bolio 5008S, which is a Super 8 camera, and it had all these fancy features you could do stop motion on it. And I shot, my very first big production was called Day Pac-Man Ate the Earth. And like all kids in the early 80s, we were very influenced by, you know, video games. And I love Pac-Man more than anything else. So I made this film about Pac-Man eating the Earth, and he saves, the Earth is suddenly saved by Miss Pac-Man. And, you know, it was a very dramatic piece for someone 10 years old.
But Spielberg kind of took you under his wing in a way and mentored you somewhat?
And he showed me how to, you know, use the equipment and how to do, you know, special effects. And, you know, and I think the core, what I really learned from him is just storytelling and the key, the characters. And, you know, even at 10 years old, I think that is carried on even to my filmmaking today, where I love telling stories about people. And I love the big special effect movies. But, you know, critical element and to filmmaking is really the relation between your heroes and having your audience have compassion for them, and if nothing else, understand them as they go on through their journey, you know. So that's what I learned from Mr. Spielberg.
Well, that's a great teacher to have. I mean, if you're going to pick one teacher, that's a good influence.
he's the master.
4 years after Poltergeist, the kind of inevitable sequel came up, the summer of 86. Same core group together for the sequel. But was the environment different? Did it feel like a different kind of experience, that second film?
It was Brian Gibson, who directed, had a very different style than Toby Hooper. He was very specific in how he told actors what he wanted to do. He had a very, a vision of what he foresaw the movie looking like. So he directed us and told us where to stand and how, and was very specific. Toby was a little more open in terms of how we should act, and, you know, gave us the leeway in terms of ad-libbing and what we could actually do in terms of our dialogue. And that's there are two different styles of filmmaking, and I'm not saying either of them are better, but, you know, every filmmaker has a style of directing and working with children, and he had a distinctly different style.
And as an actor, and now as a director, what style do you prefer?
You know, sometimes on a film you have to be, you know, very specific, you know, for various technical reasons. But, you know, when I'm working, especially working with children, I like to refer back to something I learned in film school, if I can film geek out on you. Truffaut compared working with children to a helicopter shot. And he said, you know, when you want to get the helicopter ready, it takes all day. You've got to get all the equipment and, you know, gear it up, and you got to get up in the air. And you only get a couple minutes of really good film time after the helicopter goes up, after all this preparation. And he compared that to working with children, that, you know, you have to prepare them and you have to work with them and you have to get them into a certain mindset because they don't understand the craft quite yet because they're kids. But when you do, what you finally receive is something so wonderful because it's so natural that it was worth all the time in the world to, you know, give the kids the leeway to just be kids. And those are the best kind of performances, you know, going all the way back to, you know, Charlie Chaplin and The Tramp, you know, in the performances I love watching and also love working with kids today as well.
Tell me about working with Heather.
Heather was a fantastic, you know, precocious, beautiful little girl. And I think if she had lived, she would have had a major impact on our world. She was very talented and so bright for someone only 5 years old. You know, sometimes you forget that she actually was 5 years old. And we became, you know, very, very good friends on set. She visited me at my childhood house, and it was just a horrible tragedy that we lost her.
Yeah. Is there any, I mean, obviously you're very blessed to have started your career with this enormously successful franchise, but are there any drawbacks to being a part of something that big?
Not that I can think of offhand. I just feel very blessed that I have this wonderful opportunity to work with such great people and learn how to, you know, how to make a movie the best possible way. I don't think there's any better team of people I could have learned from. And I just feel I'm really grateful I was given this opportunity to work with that team. And I think there isn't any drawback to that.
When you when your film consciousness kind of grew, you pursued it in your schooling, and what are the, what were the films and the filmmakers that were of particular influence on you?
I would say I had a vast array of movies that had impact on me. Everyone from Preston Sturges to, you know, because he's such a wonderful writer and director as well, too. And all the screwball comedies going all the way up to Frank Capra, you know, and his period of filmmaking. And I love those performances with Jimmy Stewart and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. You know, going in and you have, you know, Scorsese or Taxi Driver, you know, those raw performances that are so utterly real. And then, of course, you know, Mr. Spielberg's movies, who are, you know, his films are timeless. Jaws, I can watch a thousand times and never gets old. And it's probably better than many films even made today. And I think in 50 years from now, 100 years from now, people are going to watch Jaws and think this is a fantastic movie, because it will be timeless.
It's a perfect film. I mean, I've always said that about Jaws. It's perfect. I mean, there are very few perfect works of art, and that's one of them, I think.
It's amazing how flawless that movie is and how genius the filmmaking is of everything from the scripting to the performances. And after you hear of all the problems they had on that production, you realize, you know, what an amazing filmmaker Steven Spielberg is.
Tell me what directing does for you that acting didn't.
Directing, you can. I love telling stories, and film is like a language like anything else. So you're able to control the language and how you tell your story, what kind of shots you plan, and build suspense, and you create a relationship with your audience. And sometimes you want to give them information, sometimes you withhold it to create a level of suspense. And I love telling different kinds of stories, you know, whether it's a dramatic piece, a family piece, or it's a comedy. And my mission is just to truly just entertain and at the same time move them, whatever kind of story I'm trying to, you know, convey to an audience.
So when you end up making your own independent films, what surprises you about the process and yourself in that role of director?
You know, it's funny. You think you know everything after every production. Like, this time my next movie is going to be utterly perfect, and I'm never going to make these mistakes again. But what you learn, you know, it's somewhat of a humbling experience, because you realize you really know nothing on every production. Every production is its own series of, you know, problem-solving issues. And, you know, given that, it's still you still have a great time, because I love the process. I love figuring out what you're going to do when it's raining or a camera goes down or you lose your light and you only have 20 minutes to get, you know, 12 different shots as you need, and then you have to reduce that to 3 different shots. So that's part of the process that, you know, that you really learn that it's always an adventure and you're always going to be, you know, struggling to get exactly what you want. And, you know, in the end, if you can tell your story and get the shots you need, you feel like you've made the day and you feel like you've accomplished something.
Doesn't it feel strange to you that you, and I've spoken to other filmmakers about this dynamic, that you spend so much time developing the script in pre-production, making sure that all the T's are crossed and the I's dotted, and the shortest amount of time you're allowed is actually to shoot it, but you're incredibly rushed when you're shooting it?
I mean, I think, what was that interesting quote, Sun Tzu, Art of War? The war is won before it's fought. And I think that's critical with filmmaking. And not saying you're at a war, because it's very artistic, but you're fighting so many different elements when you are in production. So the core, and I've learned, you know, if you do your homework ahead of time, you have your complete shot list. And that's not to say you have to go with the shot list, but you at least have a roadmap of where you want to go, and you have a vision of what you want the audience to see. And as long as you can provide that to your crew and you have a clear vision to, you know, your crew and cast, you're going to probably have an easier time telling the story that you want to tell, and you'll be left with less frustration, you know, in the editing room, and you won't be regretting, oh, I should have done my homework a little more.
And what about the process of writing? Because I mean, you've written several projects that you've helmed as well. Is that, I know some people enjoy it very much, and other people find it very, very taxing and almost torturous. Where do you fall in that?
I have different experiences on writing. Some days you have these wonderful days where you can write 12, 13 pages of material and it flows right out of you. Other times it's like sweating blood and you're thinking, how do I get this story to work? And you realize through my process that sometimes the most elegant solution is something so simple, but it's not easy to actually come to that conclusion because you have to, you know, go through multiple variations. And your goal when an audience is watching your movie that it's completely seamless, so they don't see any of the seams of the various act structure and all the various beats, that they just watch the movie, they're entertained, you take them up, you take them down, and, you know, they're enjoying the journey.
And do you find that having acted, that it gives you, it's beneficial as a director, especially when you're directing actors?
You know, most definitely, because as an actor, you know, you're insecure because you're trusting yourself to a director, and you're hoping that individual is going to give you all the tools to give your, so you can give your best performance, and you're really putting yourself out there, and you're really, when you're on screen, you're taking risks, because you really don't know how, you know, your performance is going to perceive. Is it the right tone? Are you too high? Are you too big? And it's a job of director to guide the actors, you know, so there's a continuity of performance, and it requires a huge amount of trust. And having acted, I understand what an actor is going through, and I appreciate that. So I try to be, you know, very sensitive to the needs of an actor and understand they're not, quote-unquote, I've heard people say, and I found this very frustrating, they're a meat puppet, you know, and they're really, their performance is secondary, you know, to all the technology. A lot of directors end up becoming almost traffic directors, and they love the technology, and I love telling stories through the visual design. However, what an audience is truly watching are the performances, you know, and that's what's going to thrust your story along, and that's what's going to make your movie.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I see that a lot, and I have a friend that actually teaches film at an area university, and he says the same thing, that students are just enraptured by the technology of it. And he says you can't forget the beating heart in the movie and what your audience is going to follow. They couldn't care less about what it's shot on or that tracking shot if they're not invested in the actors they see on the screen.
It's critical you understand, you know, the language of filmmaking. You have to understand, when should I pull out the dolly shot? You know, if you only have a couple hours in the day and you have this large crane, is that going to make it into your cut? You know, is it worth committing those 3 hours to get it lit because it's a far shot? You know, and those are the questions you have to ask yourself. So, you know, it should almost be second nature, you know, the visual design and all the shots, all your tools of how you're going to tell your story. And I almost like to think of it as, you know, when you're climbing Everest, I understand, I've never climbed Everest, but you get up to a certain point in your life where you're climbing the mountain, they say, and everything you do should be second nature because you have so little oxygen you can barely think. And I like to think of, you know, filmmaking to some degree is like that. You're under the gun when you're trying to tell your story, and all the shots that you know should all be in your, you know, arsenal, should be almost all second nature.
Mm-hmm. And what are you working on now?
Right now I'm finishing up a film called 29 Fishes, One Regret. It's a micro-budget movie. We actually shot the entire film for under $1,000, and I used friends and a lot of the DSLR equipment, which is, you know, wonderful. And I've learned, you know, if you know what you're doing, or you have at least a vision of what you'd like to get, you don't need a million people there because it comes down to you and your performances. The whole film only has two actors through the entire film, and it's about this young couple who, in the wake of the recession, lose everything. And they go into a very dark place in their lives. So they decide to charge up their credit cards, have one last hurrah, spend all their money, what they have left on their credit cards, and then commit suicide. So it's, you know, it's a very dark message. However, at the same time, you know, what I want the audience to understand is the value of life and how this really isn't ever an option, and how what we have in our lives, what's most important is the love of our friends and our family, and, you know, momentary possessions come and go, but with the core meaning of our lives is really our relationships to others and who we care most about.
And you said that you're in post on that now? Or?
We're editing it right now, actually, and we're maintaining our under $1,000 budget. You know, and I've made films for – I've written films that have been several million dollars. However, you know, when you get down to it, the most important thing is really the storytelling. And I think we have something, you know, very interesting. I think people will have a connection with, especially in the times we're in right now. And I hope I can, through this film, even though it has dark elements, I can really, you know, give out a positive message and, you know, move people in that respect.
You're wanting to go through the festival circuit, I would think.
Yes. Well, we're going to hopefully be done by the end of the summer, and then we'll enter the festival circuit, and it'll be out there for all to see, and it'll go to DVD, and then like Netflix.
Thanks for tuning in to the Movie Geeks United Summer of 1986 series. Tune in to our next installment when we delve into one of the biggest comedies from that summer, Ruthless People, with screenwriter Dale Lawner.